Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we begin the show by taking a look at native plants. They can add a lot to, I think, your landscape and certainly to mine as well. And our guest, Susan Carpenter, can help us along that goal. She's the native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. She's been with us one other time. We're here now to answer your questions, any that you may have about starting or maintaining native plantings. Do you have some native plants in your garden? What natives are blooming in your landscape right now? I bet you for some people there's some weird ones blooming that maybe already bloomed before. We'll find out as we visit with you and with Susan Carpenter. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. Love to hear from you. And Susan Carpenter, welcome back.
Hi. Good. Great to be here.
You know, I often start this show when we're talking about the Arboretum to have whoever's here describe it for us, because I think a lot of people know about it, but it is such a gem.
Right.
I think it really we need to talk a little more about what it is.
Yeah, well, in general, the Arboretum is 1,200 acres here in Madison, and we are a teaching and research facility or center of the university. So we have our primary mission to restore and conserve the land itself, all the plants and animals, wildlife, and so forth. We maintain 20 miles of trails so people have a way to make their way around the Arboretum. And we also do a lot of research at the Arboretum, both staff and scientists from the university.
If you want to look, I mean, there's prairies, there's woodlands, there's
wetlands,
there's savannas.
Yep.
You'll find springs there, I think.
Right, around the lake, Wingra. And we have two garden areas in the Arboretum as well. So when you come to the visitor center, you'll find the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens, which are a tree and shrub collection of 6,000 specimens, roughly. And that's a spectacular display. And then we have the Native Plant Garden, which is immediately around the visitor center, and that's to demonstrate the uses of native plants in home landscapes and other landscapes.
Do we have some native plants blooming at this time?
We sure do. This is a peak time for the prairies especially. And so things that are blooming now, the gentians have come into bloom. The asters are just coming into bloom, the huge diversity of asters in the sunflower family. And then also in the sunflower family, we have the goldenrods, many different kinds of native goldenrods. And of course, the grasses, the prairie grasses, and everything's
beautiful.
Just a little taller than usual this year with all the rain that we've had.
Yeah, it was just a wonderful growing season, wasn't it?
It sure has been.
Well, we have several people online with questions. Let's go to Dan in Superior first. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I actually live outside of Superior in the eastern edge of Douglas County, and I'm very fortunate to have some regular wild trilliums growing through the woods in the springtime. Now, I noticed another plant, and I've been trying to figure out what it was for years until a friend let me borrow a different, we researched it in a little bit different book. And it looks like, and is this strange, but I found a noodler trillium.
Do you have a scientific name of that species?
Well, it says that I'm sorry, I don't. It says that it's all East Coast, you know, everywhere that I look. I haven't seen anything to the west, and I'm wondering, is this, you know, how did something like that ever get here? It's a beautiful little plant. It's so distinct that I was like, wow, what is this? Because it was about mid-chin high, almost knee-high, but three large leaves. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed some berries on it one year, and then the second year, I looked, and the flowers are hidden underneath the big leaves.
Okay. Well, what would be really great is to see a picture of it and to see that you know, as far as you've researched it so far, if you want to email that over to me at the Arboretum, that would be great. I could take another look at it and see. It is not unusual for plants from a different area to show up kind of suddenly. Sometimes we it's because we haven't really looked hard enough, but other times we'll see something that is established on the East Coast and it shows up in an area kind of as a surprise. I found one a few weeks ago in one of our woodlots that was actually an orchid, invasive orchid, strange as that might sound, and it showed up in one of our woodlots, and I just happened to find it because we were citing, locating a location for a sign. So you've got to be ready for surprises. But I would see a picture of that and maybe the name that you have so far, and I could get back to you with some more information.
Okay, very good.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we have a link on our Facebook page to the Arboretum, I'm sure. But what's the...
Website is very easy. It's arboretum.wisc.edu.
arboretum.wisc.edu. There we have it. And we have a link. I'm sure, KP, we've got a link. Yeah, he says, of course. We got a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well. Linda in Germantown has something for us. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I want to know how to keep the, I have wild phlox, wild geraniums, wild petunias, Asclepias, butterfly weed, and ironweed, and a lot of natives trying to grow together, but some of them don't play very friendly. And so I'm wondering, how are you supposed to keep them apart somehow, or control the feeding, or... I mean, it sounds like a loaded question.
Right.
Yeah.
That is a really good question, and it probably has a long answer. One thing I would suggest is sometimes it does seem as though we're getting too much of a good thing with many native. If you have a well-established garden, you'll have a lot of seeds, and sometimes the plants are spreading also with their root systems. So you learn about each plant, and you can gather the seed, and that's often when the seed becomes just ready to gather. You go ahead and gather it, and then you can give that away to people who want more seed from native plants, because otherwise they have to purchase those. As far as the plants that are spreading by their root systems, you do want to kind of keep a check on that. If you have a small area and you find that, say, one plant is dominating the whole area or shading out smaller plants. And you can simply do that by your regular gardening practices, weeding, trimming back, and that will, digging up a little bit of the root system, and that will bring it back under control and let the other plants thrive. I find it very difficult to do the kind of planting where you just have individual specimens separated and they're supposed to stay there. In their position, that really doesn't work too well for me.
You know that very well, don't you, Linda?
Is there any anything that we're supposed to know more about grasses that would help them separate? Also, I mean, in a more natural way, that more grasses should be included, or?
Well, there are many native grasses that are suitable for lots of different situations, and I find in the home environment, if you have a relatively small garden or you're concerned about sight lines, that the shorter grasses work very well. If you have a dry site, the little blue stem is a bunch grass. Prairie drop seed is a bunch grass. So those tend to stay in one spot. Now, they will seed and make more individuals, but they're not going to spread by their underground root system and spread over a whole area.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, as we visit with Susan Carpenter of the UW Arboretum, talking about native plants today. John in Appleton up next. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for all you do. And we love we visited the Arboretum from Appleton, and so
wonderful.
Kudos to what you're doing there. We've been homeowners for about 20-some years in our home here, and we raise a garden. Garden dimensions are about 5 or 6 feet wide by about 30 feet long. Mm-hmm. in the same yard, we've always had a problem with Creeping Charlie. One of my neighbors seems to have burned his lawn to improve and ameliorate the situation, get rid of all the weeds, and kind of start from fresh. Apparently, there's a website among many out there. I want to get these things out of here permanently.
The Creeping Charlie?
Creeping Charlie, yeah. It's kind of mixed in with our flower garden and vegetable garden.
Yeah. Well, it's a little off topic, but Susan, do you deal with that at the Arboretum?
Well, we do. Pretty much a lot of the practices that we have for gardening are actually practices which encourage some of our weedier species. So our lawns, where we're walking around a lot, if you're not using chemicals, and we don't at the Arboretum, we are going to have a relatively diverse lawn area, and part of that would be Creeping Charlie. It moves into the beds, as you've mentioned, and you have a relatively long and narrow bed that you described there, 6 by 30 feet. So it has a lot of edge that's adjacent to where the Creeping Charlie is. We generally, and I probably do this pretty much every day in some area or another, we do weed it at this time of year when it's forming kind of a mat across areas where we're growing other plants or where we're planting something or where we're pulling other weeds. But in the early spring, and I'll just put in one little pitch for Creeping Charlie, and that is that when it's blooming in the spring, it's a time when the bumblebees that are a very important native pollinators are emerging from the ground. The queens, who will be the future queens, the queens for next year, they emerge early in the spring, and they're the only bumblebees present at that time because they have to start the colony, and they'll and they need a nectar source, and they use the Creeping Charlie extensively where it's present. Otherwise, they might use wildflowers or flowering trees, but I think it could be quite important in certain areas for them. I don't know what the rest of your area out there in Appleton is like, but you might just take that into consideration.
You know, I have my daughter and I have, you know, you start getting too much Creeping Charlie, and we go out and spend a half hour to an hour. It's amazing how much you can pull.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not getting it all,
right?
But you're getting the rest of the plants. kind of a head start, or
What we usually do is after it blooms, it begins to do its horizontal colonizing, and at that time it's not very deeply rooted in. So right after it blooms, which is when the bees don't need it anymore anyway, you can get those runners that are moving from the main part of the plant, and that's actually easier than later on once those roots have attached into the ground a little more thoroughly.
But you can do an awful lot. Mm-hmm. In even 30 minutes. A couple of people out there for an hour are going to make a lot of dent.
Right.
In
need
the creeping.
Need a small work party to help.
Well, yeah. Help the more help, the better. But kind of a fun thing to do. Anyway, that's what we got for you, John. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. A listener who couldn't stay on the line said that she cares for monarch larvae, and she wonders whether the, and others as well, I guess, other larvae as well, and wonders whether the larvae will feed off the Joe Pye weed. We thought milkweed was the sole host plant.
Well, for the monarchs, the larvae will only feed on milkweed, so that is an issue for the caterpillars. However, the adult butterflies, as soon as they come out of the chrysalis, need to have nectar, and they will use milkweed for a nectar source, but they need a wide range of other nectar plants. And so right now we've been seeing more monarchs, and these late summer plants that are blooming now are native thistles, are the different asters and other plants that the monarchs are using, that liatris in particular. They They need those that nectar source in order to make the migration. So, and other butterflies as well need these late season sources because they are they're either laying eggs and still laying eggs and getting caterpillars to overwinter, or, well, the monarchs, of course, are migrating to Mexico now, so they need a lot of fuel to make that long trip.
Talking today with Susan Carpenter, native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Question about native plants and native plantings? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. KP Whaley, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. Just to mention, next week, Ben Fuda comes back from the Allen Centennial Gardens, and he's going to be talking about some flower bulbs that you may have overlooked and want to plant yet this fall. That's one of the things we can talk about with him. Right now, visiting with Susan Carpenter of the UW-Madison Arboretum, taking a look at native plants and plantings with her. And our lines are all filled at 800-642-1234. But you can still email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And before we go back to the phones, just want to talk about the Native Gardening Conference that's coming up, because I think a lot of people would be interested in attending.
Right. We have our annual Native Gardening Conference coming up on Sunday, September 18th, and it's an all-day conference, and we really pack it full of great information. I'm really excited about the program this year. Our keynote speaker will be Heather Holm, who's an author of a book called Pollinators of Native Plants, and she'll be sharing a lot of information about not just pollinators, but also beneficial insects. And the simple definition of a beneficial insect might be it's the insect that eats the insect you don't want, and also provide other services for us. We have other workshops offered about design, about gravel gardens. Jeff Epping will be joining us for that one. We have one on rain gardens and edible restoration. So
very cool. So yes. Lots of, and so that's the 18th?
On the 18th. And the deadline for registration, which you can just do online at arboretum.wisc.edu, is next Thursday, September 8th. So we want everybody to be registered by then so we can get all prepared for the conference.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we'll bring it up again. But let's turn to John and Shano next with a question. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, guys.
Hi, John.
Love your show, as always. Kind of sort of native questions. 4 years ago in May, one of my oak trees in my front yard decided to lose one of its huge branches. It went right through the roof of my house. Uh-huh. Anyway, but so I had that cut to just a 9 or 10 foot stump. Hoping to be able to carve something out of that. It was just too bad on the inside. The screener, I mentioned a different story. I'll get to it very, very quickly. I've been getting wonderful, huge puffball mushrooms, which, anyway, I looked it up. They're only good eating if you pick them ripe. But right now I'm looking at one that is about almost 9 inches long and 6 inches wide and about 6 inches tall. Anyway, I've mowed over a couple other ones already this season. So I'm sure I'll get a lot more mushrooms, but what is the name of your fun guy? Previous shows. Well, actually, so when that went down, being the cheap guy I am, I plant in the fall when shrubbery is, you know, the vacant area, you know, now the sunlit area.
Right.
Three shrubs that I got 75% off in the fall down at, you know, my local, gardener. And The middle one is a Japanese something or other, which is very beautiful, but non-flowering. The two that I planted on either side, I cannot remember the name, but they finally flowered this year. And they have these huge, huge, lovely, they're mostly white, and they're, now they're turning a pinkish, a huge, not just one flower, you know, a plethora of flowers on one. So the entire plants, both shrubs, have drooped right down to the ground, basically.
So what might be the cause of that?
So they look like like they wilted?
It's just the weight of all these big...
Okay. So there doesn't appear to be anything really wrong with them. They're just so heavy and full that they couldn't...
Absolutely correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I don't know that there's much you can do about that, is there? I mean, people tie up some of their plants.
Yeah, it really depends. Sometimes people will use branches, like if you have to mow around it or work near it, they'll use a forked branch that they've gotten from another, you know, from tree clearing or whatever, to prop the branches up a bit, you know, keep them, lift them off the ground. I'm not sure what kind it is. I wonder, are they might be hydrangeas, ones...
That is a very good possibility.
Because they would be, hydrangeas are blooming now. So I think, and then often, I find this isn't just true of hydrangeas and of shrubs, but some of the other native plants, after they bloom, they do, and they've produced they're producing their seeds now, they do tend to kind of flop over, and that I think is just a natural part of the, you know, of the plants. It seems to be a natural part of the plant's life cycle. It's not that anything's wrong with it; it's just that it's kind of gotten its sunlight, and now it's producing its seeds, and now this way of dispersing the seeds nearby. The hydrangeas, I guess, I would say if they're not cracking and there's no damage to them, that you might just want to use caution around working around them, or maybe prop those branches up a bit with, you know, temporarily to mow or whatever you might have to do in that area.
I stuck a lawn chair under some, and actually for a week between mowings, and they stayed up a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's another option. I didn't know that would work. Thanks for that.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, I want to give, John, thanks. I want to give Tammy and Madison a chance to join us. So let's go there. Tammy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I have a front yard that I cleared the grass out of, and I tried various things. I would like to get it into native plantings, various, you know, ways of bringing in the native plantings. I don't need to put any grass up there if I can get away with it. However, it's just so weedy that it's impossible. It seems impossible and completely overwhelming to consider doing anything but just grass so that it can
be mowed.
You know,
yeah, you
compete the weeds. I have bishop's head. I have some viney thing that has a white flower on it now that I don't know where that came from. Creeping Charlie, that one's easy to pull up, but the bishop's head is terrible. I just don't even know how to prepare the space.
Yeah, I think you've brought up a really good point, and that is at the beginning of the planting, people do tend to want to get to the planting the natives right away, and preparation is really a huge proper preparation of the site is a huge thing. The bishops, if it's a gout weed or bishop's weed, that one is a very difficult one to work with. I've had it come in a shady area in the garden, and we were able actually to control it with hand pulling. But in an open area, if it's well established, you're really probably looking at herbicide to get that taken care of. If you have perennial weeds, you'll want to make sure you've done multiple treatments so that they don't pop back up when you think you've got them, you know, solved for one at a first treatment. And so you might consider, it depends entirely, Tammy, on which weeds they are and what you know, so the technique would depend on what they are. If mm-hmm. you may want to consider having someone who has a consulting, you know, who does landscape, native landscaping, take a look at your site and yeah. decide the best course for you to get a good head start on that planting.
Yeah.
How big is the area?
Yeah, how big is it?
Well, it's my front yard and the boulevard along the road. So it's a pretty sizable space.
Mm-hmm. And is it shady or sunny?
No, it's sunny. At the point of me killing off the grass, the city cut down the tree that was actually killing the grass. And so I ended up with this open space that was very different from the original plan.
Yes.
But I mean, I've got the neighbors put some bird seed out, and so I ended up with Canadian thistle up there. And that's
wow.
kind of the only thing I've been listening to Garden Talk. I learned that one I need to, I'm probably going to need to use herbicide on, but I was
yeah.
trying to do the rest of them naturally.
Right,
and
right.
I think
that's why I said it depends on what the particular
yeah.
weeds are and what your site looks like. So
you're saying kind of stick with it and get it clear and then worry about planting. Just not even think about planting till I can feel pretty confident about the space.
Well, I would say, if you have someone take a look at it specifically
yeah.
for your site, then they can go from there. But it is true that preparing the site properly is really worth doing. And it
yeah.
you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and sometimes she fills it up with weeds. So
yeah, and if it's too large, I mean, you can if you don't want to use chemicals, you can cover it. But
if it's too large, then that'll do.
That's a real problem if it's a big area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there might be a part of it that's relatively easily prepared, and
covered.
You could start with that, and then
yep.
some persistent
okay.
problems take care of those over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Great.
Thanks
Thank
for calling.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Steve in Milwaukee, we turn to you next. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm calling about two issues. The first is my milkweed. I have it right outside of our kitchen window. And the pots are absolutely covered by these tiny orange insects.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the other pods appear to be at some point covered with eggs or something. And now it appears to be a bunch of larvae all over these pots. I mean, just covered. Every inch, every part of the surface is covered in these things. So I need to be concerned about this.
Okay.
And then I have another question after that about a vine that's growing through my other wildflowers.
Okay. On the milkweed pods, are these insects, are they on the outside of the pod, or are they kind of within the pod as well?
No, they're outside.
Okay. And they're not, are they aphids or not?
I don't know. They are blaze orange.
Okay. I think what you're seeing there are really milkweed bugs, and they come in different sizes, and the tiny ones are, there can be quite a few of them in a pod. In fact, I was showing some of my volunteers the interior of a milkweed pod, and it was somewhat split, so I split it the rest of the way open, and all these milkweed bugs came pouring out of there and surprised everybody. But that's actually a very natural thing to be seeing now. I would okay. not be concerned about it. You'll find, is this the common milkweed or?
Yes, it is. It's
okay.
Common.
So I can assure you, you're going to have plenty of milkweed seeds. If you're collecting those, you'll have plenty
okay.
of common milkweed going forward. You'll have it popping up in places you weren't expecting. And
it's growing in my lawn. I'm mowing around it.
Yep. Okay. Yep, I totally believe that. So you don't need to be concerned about those bugs. The milkweed itself has a whole world of its own insects, and those are one of the members.
Fantastic. When should I harvest the seeds? I have a friend who wants them.
At this point, what I would wait until the pods are still green, but as they become a little more dry and you begin to see a split in the pod where it would naturally open,
yep.
that's a good time because then the seeds are mature enough.
Oh, fantastic. And then I've got one other thing. We've got a whole bunch of wildflowers, cup plants, compass plants, blue false indigo, all kinds of stuff. And there is a weedy vine, though, that seems to have gotten into our wildflowers. and it's really long, and it kind of grows. It sometimes has these little berries that start white, and they do turn. They actually will turn to a red color, and as I say, and we also have some arborvitae separating the wildflowers from the rest of the yard, and they so this vine will wind its way up the arborvitae, and sometimes I'll get it, and I can pull, you know, 8-10 feet of this stuff out.
Right. I'm not really getting an ID from the verbal description, but if you could send a photograph of that plant or sure. just a section of it, sure. that would be very helpful. If you can email that to either info@arboretum.com or to me at the Arboretum, I can take a look at it and get back to you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan Carpenter, our guest from the UW Arboretum, talking about native plants today with her. Someone wondered about the term, I think you may have used volunteer.
Oh.
And they wondered, well, what's volunteer?
Oh, well, I won't name any names of volunteers, but I work in the native plant garden at the Arboretum. I work with about 60 volunteers a season doing native plant gardening. And just the larger picture of volunteering at the Arboretum, I've mentioned about the trails and the hiking and so forth earlier, and our conference, of course, but we have so many opportunities for the community to get involved at the Arboretum in all kinds of capacities. So volunteers a huge word at the Arboretum, and we love our volunteers.
And when it comes to plants, sometimes you'll hear a volunteer, or we've got a volunteer.
Right. That's for plants, it's a volunteer plant is one that shows up where you weren't expecting it.
Just volunteered. Oh, man. Adele emailed, says, I have what I think is tansy growing in my yard, tall plant with yellow flowers. I think it's a weed and wonder if this is a native.
Yeah, tansy is not a native, and I have not encountered it. It hasn't volunteered in the garden yet, so I don't know too much about control, but if you have it, you can go ahead and kind of use your own gardening skills to sort of detect what would be the best method for control for it. In general, when you have a plant coming in, you're not sure whether you should trust it yet. One good thing to do is to not let it reproduce, and then start figuring out about if you're going to remove it, start figuring out about its root system and what the best, you know, kind of timing and methods for getting rid of it. If it's a shallowly rooted plant, you might be able to dig it up. If it's a very, very deep rooted plant, then you might need a spot treatment or hit it at a certain time of year, just depending.
Catherine in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
I'm calling about May apples.
Mm-hmm.
So I have I don't have a huge garden, but I have a spot of May apples that's maybe 5x5. And here I actually got a couple May apples right before the squirrels or chipmunks got them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering, what's the best way to protect them from animals so that I can actually eat the May apples? And also if there's anything I can co-plant with them so that when they die back in August or start looking peaked, I can still have some other plants alive in that area.
Right. Well, a couple things about May apples. One thing to remember is that you'd never eat them unless they're extremely ripe, because
right.
the plant is toxic. So I just want to get that out there. But as far as growing them, they are a spring blooming plant. So then they do tend to go into their dormant period, especially if we have a dry period, they tend to go into their dormant period, you know, midsummer. And we have them growing in areas where we have other woodland plants. So I have an area where there's some zigzag goldenrod. There's other there's ferns and other natives that live in the same areas as May apples do. And I have one area where they persist pretty long into the season because it's kind of moist and north on a north-facing side of a building. And there I have cardinal flower blooming with them, and that's very pretty. So if it's the same, you know, if it's a suitable spot for cardinal flower, you might try that.
Does that need good drainage for cardinal flower?
Cardinal flower likes a moist area, too.
Okay. Yeah, it's a fairly moist area. It's just not very good drainage.
You might try a couple of cardinal flowers and see how they do.
Okay, great. And any ideas for keeping the squirrels?
Oh, boy.
Do you need to put a cage around the whole thing?
You'd have to almost, like, cage up above it, too, right? I don't know on that. I've often wondered how it is that the squirrels and chipmunks can always tell about a week before you're planning to do something with the fruit or nuts, how they figure out that the week before is the week that they'll go in and get it.
Right, yeah.
So, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Catherine. Thanks. Appreciate it. And Aaron in Pascal, your turn now. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello. It's actually Presque Isle.
Presque Isle. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much for taking my call here today.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, for about almost 10 years now, we've pretty much dedicated most of our 40 acres to a wildflower sanctuary. And it's been growing out progressively from around the house. And so this last year, however, was one very strange weather, but also coincided with us doing something new in the fall. We had a basically a clear cut of the 4 acres around the house.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much a mulch, but it was more of an aggressive takedown.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally what we would do is just let them stand all winter on their own accord, and of course, throughout the summer, I go around and play Johnny Appleseed, you know, getting the seeds, putting them into a bucket, redistributing.
Right.
So what we're really trying to do is just hone in on what is the current advice regarding how to take down the fields in the winter to prepare for the next season. The only other thing that I can add is the only fertilizers we use is Morganite spread in the spring and summer.
Okay, so you've been is the area you're are you spreading? You still want to continue spreading the wildflowers?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay, but the area now is quite different. Has it been?
There was a lot of native tall grass that came back this year.
Okay.
And like I said, because it was also the first year where we paid somebody to come in and basically thrash everything down, you know, with the full behind tractor attachment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to see, is it me thinking that was the, you know, the impact of doing it? Because we're trying to figure out what to do this next year.
Okay.
And so I've been contemplating literally just walking around with a hand sigh, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And just, so you're talking about, is the area shaded by trees?
No, this is all open prairie.
It's open. Okay. So
some sections are shaded by trees on the perimeter, you know, but like I said, it's about 4 acres around the house. Tree lines, yes.
Okay, so there's a couple things there. I mean, one thing is that you can I don't know whether you would consider leaving the material in the fall and the plant material. And the reason I say that is because and this is a practice that we do at the Arboretum in our gardens, is we leave the material in the fall because a lot of the seed is still being spread then. Now, seed that you want to take to
We did not remove any material.
Okay. You just chopped it down.
Exactly.
Okay. So you probably
got chopped up too much.
Yeah. So you may not have as much usable seed as you wanted to spread to other areas.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I think you'll want to pay attention to the timing of the seeding of the different species and collect that seed before you bring it down. Otherwise, you're just putting seed, mature and immature seed, right down where you you've dropped it. Yeah, where you've dropped the material. And it will that material may kind of mulch itself. The seed may not get to the soil surface as well.
Typically, that's what we've done, just kind of, you know, wander through periodically, and as they come to seed, you know, get them off in the hand and then disperse them right in, you know, in that proximity. So therefore, all of our wildflowers are kind of all intermingled. There aren't, like, designated beds for a particular species.
Yeah, they don't like to stay that way.
So you're...
I guess the only other question would be, some people have mentioned maybe a burn.
Well, if it's... the thing about burning is it depends on your composition of your planting. If it is prairie plants and it is safe to do it and you have professional crews doing it, then that might be an option. You might want to, determine whether those conditions are the case and maybe get some advice. You're up in Presque Isle, so you might want to get some advice from someone locally up there who conducts prescribed fire and see if your area is suitable for it.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Aaron. Appreciate it. Susan Carpenter, our guest today, native plant gardener at the UW Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.
Here's a look at what's coming up this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from The Little Paris Bookshop by Nina George. Then stay with us from 1 till 3 for Science Friday. Today after 1, we get an update on the SpaceX rocket explosion on Thursday. After 2, a look at some promising data on a drug that treats Alzheimer's disease. And join us from 3 until 7 for Central Time.
What have you spent $2 on today? Was it as valuable, inspiring, and meaningful as what you heard on WPR? It's hard to buy much for $2, but at Wisconsin Public Radio, $2 a day helps create a lot of learning, laughter, music, and news. Consider giving $2 a day today at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, presenting 1876 Presshouse Brandy, a family-crafted spirit from Prairie du Sac that completes Wisconsin brandy old fashions. Available in stores throughout Wisconsin. Include WPR in your social mix. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for Wisconsin news, links, and photos from programs and hosts. Find all our social media links at WPR.org/community.
Taking a look at native plantings today here on Garden Talk, Larry Mueller with my guest Susan Carpenter from the UW-Madison Arboretum. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Penny in Wisconsin Rapids up next. Hi, Penny. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm a native plant enthusiast, and one question I've got is, when you're planting around your, say, your front entryway and you don't want it to look really wild and too free form, but you still want native plants, I don't know how to group things up or how to choose things that don't look too sprawling and
wild,
and a lot of people wonder that too, like they're getting more interested in native plants for pollinators, but you go, well, what looks good that doesn't offend my neighbors?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. In the city lots, usually we have sight lines and smaller spaces to consider. So what I would suggest for that is to use, if you can use some of the shorter plants, or if you're growing taller plants, like, say, New England aster, you can actually, mid-season, you can prune that back so that it makes a more bushy plant. But the shorter grasses, for example, northern drop seed or little blue stem or some of those native short grasses, depending on whether you have sun or shade, if you use that, or sedges as a matrix, and then interplant or have planted in with it some of the accent, some more accent type flowers like liatris, maybe for this time of year. But earlier in the season, you might have prairie smoke or you know, some of the midsummer, like a small coreopsis. But the main thing I think for those smaller lots and for just the, you know, the kind of wild looking, to avoid the wild looking thing is just to go shorter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know of any like examples where you could just look at pictures and go, oh yeah, that'll do good?
Well, I think, well, first of all, if you were not so far away in Wisconsin Rapids, I would uh-huh. say come over to the Arboretum because uh-huh. that's exactly what our demonstration okay. gardens are for. Uh-huh. We have the wild kind, the big tall prairie grasses and so forth, but we also uh-huh. have some shorter areas. Seeing demonstration gardens is a good way to do it. Or just looking at what, you know, in a native gardening book where it's showing different,
yeah.
it's showing different looks. Those are a really good way to decide on some selections for your own yard.
Yeah. I would just like to tell you one that really turned out nice here at my house. And I had about 5 azalea bushes planted, and in between them I put purple echinacea coneflower,
mm-hmm.
and it really looks nice in between the azalea bushes.
Yes, that is a nice combination.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Should take a photo and put it up on our Facebook page,
oh,
Penny.
That would be
maybe.
Awesome.
Yeah, that would be neat.
I would like
well,
to see it.
Thank you. Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Penny.
Thank you very much for calling. We'll have to look on that. Penny, go and do that right now. Well, wait wait a minute or two. Holly in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I've been doing kind of exhausting research on converting my lawn to something more native. I've thought about maybe like a mix of buffalo grass and blue grama grass, or maybe something totally different like sedums and creeping thymes and phlox. But yeah, I have sort of, we live in sort of a judgmental lawn neighborhood, so I don't want to, you know, totally make things look terrible, and I also don't really know what would do, you know, do well with our soil. Yeah, so any recommendations you might have?
Well, what I'd recommend in a situation like that is to start gradually, and you can, you know, perhaps create a bed or a sweep through, you know, part of the area that you're interested in converting, and try things.
Okay.
So try some short grasses, maybe some sedges, depending on what if you have shade, you could use some, you could use a shade loving sedge there instead of grass. Obviously most of the grasses don't grow well in shade. But if you have sun, then you could use some short native grasses and, you know, experiment a little bit with it. Maybe, as I just mentioned to the previous caller, do some accent planting within basically a matrix of those short grasses, and see how it works. And then if you have your lawn and a nice defined edge between your lawn and your planting, then that usually is a more aesthetically pleasing, widely aesthetically pleasing setup for people to appreciate. And then, you know, you can adjust from there and continue to expand it. If you do the whole thing at once, you might get overwhelmed, and then you might not get very good results, and then you won't be happy with how it looks or how much work you have to do to care for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Jerry in Hudson up next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I think I can identify that long vine with the plants and with the white flowers on it, because I've been cursed with it twice in two homes. So I think it's bindweed.
It looks
like a pretty little smaller flowered white morning glory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was confused because I think the caller said that it had white berries and then they turned red, but maybe they meant white flowers. There's quite a number of vining plants, so I think bindweed, of course, is a real challenge.
Yeah,
it's probably our nemesis of all time. But thanks for that. I hadn't thought in that direction. So
yeah.
I'll see what the picture is. It'd be a mystery solved.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yeah. And Nancy in New Richmond, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. We had a mystery plant appear in our garden, and we live near a lake. And the people that kind of run the Lake Association said an invasive plant called something like a Japanese knotweed starting to show up on the shore.
Yes.
And we wonder if this was a plant. I haven't been able to find a picture of it, but it was getting really tall and it had giant leaves and little bitty yellow flowers. But when you looked at the flowers, it was actually a pod with seeds.
Uh-huh.
And we went to pull it out of our garden, and the stalk was so thick and hard to cut. It was almost like bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if that was the knotweed or what it was.
It's quite possible. Did you just have one of them?
Yes.
That's good.
That's really good.
That's good.
Okay. Good they got, you got rid of it.
And I would keep an eye on that spot because it, if it is knotweed and it sounds, if you're you're mentioning that it looks like bamboo is a clue for me, that you want to keep an eye on that area and make sure there isn't, you know, that it doesn't continue to come up because it sounds like you've got it well in hand and you just want to keep it that way. The shoreline, you know, once it's loose on, with the shoreline, it can be very difficult to, you know, to control. So keep on top of it. You're always at the beginning of something like this is the time to really pay attention.
Okay. We were warned that people were actually planting it on the shoreline because it goes so well and it's kind of like a privacy.
No, no.
That's actually that it is actually true of some of our, plants that turn out to be difficult invasives later. You know, they started out as, you know, a landscaping plant or an erosion control plant, and then later we find out that really it was a, you know, that
it's
wasn't
terrible,
a good decision.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you think we should dig down? We got part of the stem off. We got a little hunk left there. Should we dig down and try to remove it out of the dirt?
I would try that, and just basically so that you can learn about what does it look like underground and where could you, has it, you know, is it going to like pop up in that area? You know, has it started to make sideways growth and, you know, under the ground that could come up in the area? Check for that and get to know it because you're going to want to keep an eye on that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much
thank
for
you, Nancy.
Taking my call.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Wanda, and have you got a quick comment?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
We had peonies, and they always want to fall down, so we used tomato cages.
Oh, that's a great idea.
To hold them up. Mm-hmm. And our kids had a lot of fun painting them different colors.
Yeah, that's true. Tomato cages can be used for if you have plants, if you have native plants that are kind of floppy, you can always use tomato cages or other kinds of artistic structures like that in your garden to help hold them up for a little while longer.
Probably better than my lawn chair. Susan,
thank you.
Susan, thanks a lot for calling, Wanda. Susan Carpenter, our guest today. Native plant gardener at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Always great to talk with her here on the Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Net for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Susan Carpenter, native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Always fun to have folks from the Arboretum on. This is a second trip for Susan. Great to have her here. You have a question for her about native plantings. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Michelle in Brookfield has something for us, so let's go there next. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
We have an awful lot of walnuts on our property, walnut trees. And in the spring, there are some nice natives. But at this time of year, what would you suggest for some color?
Okay.
And we'll play nice with the walnuts.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Is it a very shaded stand of walnuts, or do you have some open spaces in between them?
It's both. It's it's a woody area, and then we have some open area too.
Okay. So at this time of year, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're seeing a lot of the asters and goldenrods blooming. So if your site is suitable for that, you will find that many of the native plants can grow well with walnut. They're not as sensitive as some of our vegetables and stuff that really won't grow at all with walnuts. I do have a comprehensive list, and that we'll be distributing that at our native gardening conference that I mentioned earlier as well. Just for a few off the top of my head, for bloom right now, you could easily probably grow some goldenrods there. The native, we have some native thistles, if you're brave enough to do that. I have some beautiful native thistles that the pollinators are all over at, that they're just finishing blooming now. So the pasture thistle is one of those that is very versatile, depending on whether you're, you know, in town or whether you have a little bit of space to get away with growing native thistles. They're quite tall. And then some of the asters. Some of the asters are shade tolerant, slightly shade tolerant, or quite shade tolerant.
I haven't had any luck with like a New England type of aster.
Might
is
be
there something else?
Well, yes. You might try arrow-leafed aster, or flat-topped aster, which I have not grown under a walnut, but I do. But it grows well in shade, so I would. You might want to check to see if that one is sensitive. But and you can get some information. You can get information about those lists by looking up native plants that are sensitive to or not sensitive to the juglone compound that the roots release in the case of walnuts.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
All right.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Sure. We have Bob from Richland Center says he would love to support more natives, but he doesn't have a small front yard to dedicate. He has 5 acres, and he can't afford to hire a prairie restoration company to come in and do maybe $10,000 worth of restoration. Any suggestions?
Okay. 5 acres is a nice piece, and I guess the first question I would have for Bob would be if he knows what's growing there now. That's the main thing. The different aspects of the site, the vegetation that's doing well on it now. If there's a lot of invasive shrub species that would need to be removed, we're back into the preparation being the most important part of the process. If the area doesn't have if it's a wooded area, then of course, you know, you'd be considering different plants than if it's an open prairie area or a south-facing slope. So all those, the main thing to do is kind of take a look at your site and see what features does it have. One of the workshops that we're offering at our Native Gardening Conference is how to design a native garden or a small-scale restoration. And that's the approach that some of the principles that will be talked about there would be the approach I would take. Site analysis, vegetation identification of what's there, and seeing what would be possible for you to put into place. So Bob might be a really great candidate for recommending to come to our conference, because he would really get a comprehensive view of his land and some of the possibilities.
Go back over that for those who are tuning in later. What's the conference all about, and when is it, and so forth?
We have a Native by Design conference. We're talking about native plant gardening, and we hold this conference on Sundays, September 18th, from 8:45 until 4:30. And it's ideal for people who are either have a home garden, small-scale restoration, either interested in starting one or continuing with caring for one that they already have started. So there's a lot of workshops there's a workshop about design. There's a workshop about planting and maintaining the garden. There's a workshop about living soils and how important soils can be. We also have a workshop on butterfly gardening. There's 8 different workshops plus a native plant garden tour for people to choose from.
So there's lots going on.
A lot going on that day. It's a really great day, and you get to meet a lot of fellow gardeners and people with their own experience, and we have a lot of resources available for people to take home as well that day. Our keynote will be Heather Holm, who's going to speak on attracting bees and beneficial insects with native plants.
And that's, again, the 18th?
It's on the 18th, and the registration is online at arboretum.wisc.edu, and that registration deadline is September 8th, Thursday.
So it's coming up, and you can go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, too, where you have a link to the Arboretum there and how to get onto that. It sounds like a great, sounds like perfect for Bob.
It's always fun.
Always fun. Dewey in Park Falls, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hello.
Well, good afternoon. Listen, I got kind of a little puzzle going here. I'm a truck driver, and I once in a while get this little whop of fragrance coming out of the woods or a swampy area, kind of sort of. And it's like a must, a very pleasant smelling must. And someone mentioned maybe patchouli. I'm wondering if that's correct. I looked up patchouli on the internet, seen what the plant looks like, but the habitat, I did not look to see what the habitat was, and I'm wondering if they like to grow around wet, swampy kind of areas, or it's a real pleasant smell. I don't get it very often, but when I do, I'd like to locate or find that plant, see what in the world it is.
Wow, that is a puzzler. I don't think patchouli would be growing in on your routes, but there are many plants that have secondary compounds, so when they're either disturbed or the plant's crushed, or even just from the plant itself can just release the chemicals. So I think you're going to have to do a fair amount of detective work on this and identify the areas and
I'm working my nose through the work, you know, and I'm like, gosh dang, I get cold, but it looks like I really don't recognize. I see a lot of reed area. So I'm looking for something out of the ordinary in the swamp or the reeds and stuff, but I don't see anything with any certain character that would lead me. I'm really trying to work with the nose to find
I know. This is
wonderful, too. It's a wonderful spell.
Yeah, this is very interesting because usually people are giving a visual description, and I very rarely have a question that's based on the aromatic description. But there are plants that have a lot of that have secondary compounds that are released, and maybe at a certain time of day or if it's, you know, a certain time of year. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be a flower. So it could be just the foliage.
I wish I could. You know, I'll call you back, Larry, if I ever do find it. Let you know.
That'd be great.
All right, Dewey.
I got my wife working on it, so I'll do what I can. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. Well, you'd like to know what that is and be able to maybe have some in your own yard. But it sounds like it needs wet feet almost to work well. Mark in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. For the first time in many years, the Moors missed the cardinal flowers in the ditches along the road over here. And I was wondering how to go about collecting the seed and propagating them. That's Lobelia cardinalis.
Right. The time of year for collecting the seed from them is coming soon. This plant, if it's in a suitable place, in a place that it alone knows that it prefers, it will continue year after year in that same spot. Otherwise, I've noticed that you'll have it for a couple of years, but then it will that individual will not persist, and then it'll have to seed itself. So one thing about seeding with plants like that is that they often need a little bit of disturbance nearby for the seeds to get onto bare soil and you know, create more plants.
Right.
So if you know of an area where it does grow and it does like a moist area, or like I mentioned earlier, an area that has where it's sort of consistently moist,
right.
that's a good spot, you know, good candidate area to keep it going in. So just make sure there's some bare soil in that area, disturb it a little bit and put the seeds down, and then keep, you know, keep track of how they're, you know, whether they're coming. The first year, you won't see the flower. You'll just see a flat plant, a flat rosette plant on the ground, kind of, you know, lots of leaves, but it's very, very short and just circular. And then the second year, you'll see it coming, or a later year, you'll see it putting up the stalk.
So the seeds have to overwinter in the soil?
Generally, I don't know the specific requirement for cardinal flower, but generally for our forbs, they do require a wet, moist stratification period, which basically, if they're released at this time of year into the environment, or planted at this time of year, or a little bit later, they will then overwinter, and that will break their dormancy.
Yeah, I've got a perfect place in the south of our house.
Excellent.
Perfect.
Water Lake, Michigan is up, and there's a lot of moisture out there.
Excellent. Great. Well, I hope they come up for you.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Marilyn in Mequon, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Well, hi. I would just like to share my experience. When I started my prairie 20 years ago, I joined Wild Ones Natural Landscaping Group. And I have had wonderful success, and the preparation of the soil was the key.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just like to plug Wild Ones.
That's a great suggestion.
An excellent suggestion, Marilyn. Thanks. I was going to say it earlier, and then it slipped my mind, so I'm glad you called.
And well, it's wonderful because the chapters are all located all around the state. So.
Yes.
And then those people are, the people in all the parts of the state are so knowledgeable, and they also can provide really local information, locally appropriate information.
And the Wild Ones members are just so generous with their help, their suggestions, their support. I just can't recommend them more highly.
Yes.
So 25 years, your prairie must be really something now, Marilyn.
It's beautiful.
Wonderful.
It's beautiful. Yes. And I don't have to weed much because I burn it. And the weeding is almost nothing, maybe an hour a year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
25 years. That's wonderful. Yes. Something to be proud of there. Gloria in Shawano, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the very good-smelling plant that the gentleman smelled when he went into wet areas.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it might be sweetgrass. Sweetgrass is used by natives to make baskets. It's used in ceremony. If you get braids of it and hang it in your house, when it gets warm and kind of humid, it will make the house fragrant. So that would be my guess what he's smelling out of the...
I think
that is a very great suggestion. Yes.
That's a great guess.
Mm-hmm.
Sweetgrass.
Yep.
I hope he's still listening.
Yep.
Thank you.
That might be the answer to his mystery.
Oh,
Thank you so much.
Look that one up. He may have seen, if he gets a look at it, he may, I remember seeing those. Marilyn wants to know if you wish to plant milkweed seeds in the spring, how should you care for them until planting, and when is the best planting time?
Okay. I would actually, for reasons of breaking dormancy of the seeds, I would actually recommend that you plant your milkweed seeds, if you're planting them outdoors in your garden, just direct planting them onto the soil, is to go ahead and plant them in the fall. And then you can put a little bit of straw or maybe a light leaf mulch on them, not enough to completely mulch them, but just a little protection. Make sure they're in good contact with the soil, and then as the freeze-thaw cycle starts, they'll be brought down into the soil. And that will give them the winter treatment, and then next spring they can germinate.
We talked about your upcoming event at the Arboretum, but there are some other ones, too. The one that appealed to me was the Crabapple Cider Workshop.
Yes, this is something new this year. We have a Crabapple Cider Workshop coming up on the 24th of September, and the registration for that is due or required by September 22nd, and it is going to be about crabapple cider production and tasting and all the information about the trees, about the fruits. And we'll have the instructors there will be our curator, David Stevens, of our crabapple collection. We'll have Nick Smith from UW-Madison, Cal's. We'll have Herdy Basden, Maiden Rock Winery and Cidery, and a representative from the Wisconsin Apple Growers Association. So that's going to be a morning workshop from 9 to 12, and it should be pretty exciting.
And what's the date for that?
That's on the 24th, so register by the 22nd of September.
Okay, anything else coming up?
Well, we have our usual tours. If you want to come out and see all the things that are in bloom this end of the season and the migrating warblers and so forth, we've got our Sunday 1 p.m. free tours for the public and our families programs. These in September will be the 11th and the 25th. So both of those Sundays. And we have two night walks coming up. And those are free night walks with a naturalist. And they start at 6:30. One of them is near the full moon on September 17th. And one of them is on the equinox, September
22nd. So now what goes on at a night walk?
A night walk, you get to walk at night on the trails and see all the things that... So it'll start out in the light, but then it'll get dark. And so be ready with good footwear and
mosquito repellent, probably.
Yeah, we've had a rough mosquito season this last few weeks, but by the time it's dark, they're not
so bad.
Much.
It's right at dusk.
Yep.
I wonder why that is the case. I don't know why that's the case.
And sometimes during the day.
Dewey called back, by the way, to say he did hear the message about sweet grass and thinks that might very well be the plant.
Wonderful.
And thanks for that. Well, we've got another couple minutes to go here before we're done. What's happening with pollinators in the garden at this time of the year?
That's a great question. What we're seeing with pollinators now is, of course, we have the pollinators can include lots of different critters. We have bees, of course, butterflies, beetles, moths, flies, wasps, you name it. And a lot of them are out right now, but coming to the end of the season. So our bees are, the bumblebees we're seeing out now are mainly of just one species. A lot of them are male bumblebees because they've emerged from the colonies and they've been mating with the future queens. We have a lot of solitary bees that are just finishing up their life cycles for the year. And then the butterflies, monarchs, of course, are getting ready to migrate south to Mexico. And we've still finding a few larvae, butterfly, the monarch larvae. So those will be the new butterflies. As those hatch out, they'll be heading to Mexico. So they're all out on these late blooming species and the native species, just a tremendous diversity of plants. So some of the butterflies will be overwintering in a chrysalis form right here. The monarchs will be migrating. Some of the butterflies actually overwinter as an adult, like the morning cloak butterfly. So that's one of the first ones you'll see in the spring. It overwinters as an adult butterfly, just in dormancy.
You know, you mentioned bees, and that reminded me, the last time you were here, you talked about a citizen science project that on bees that you were coordinating.
Right.
Fill us in on that.
We have a citizen science project at the Arboretum, or it's based in the Arboretum, that was to document the bumblebees. And we've documented now 12 kinds of bumblebees at the Arboretum. And it's a photography project, basically. So people are able to take photographs of the bumblebees. And then from that, if the photos show enough of the features, we're able to identify them to species and learn more about what plants the bumblebees are using. What kinds of habitat do they need? As you know, we have rare species of bumblebees and common species of bumblebees, but with so many different species, we're anxious to increase their habitat. And if we have good habitat for bumblebees, we also have kind of automatically good habitat for a lot of these other beneficial insects and other wildlife, and also for people.
That's wonderful. How many, have you had a lot of people involved in it?
We have about 25 people who've taken the training.
Wow.
And, you know, it's there's a lot of work with photography there. So it's a pretty good, it takes some time, but it's also very rewarding.
Oh, it's got to be. And once more, again, the upcoming conference, give us
our upcoming conference will be on Sunday, September 18th, and it's an all-day conference, and a registration is available at arboretum.wisc.edu, and it's online. And that deadline for that registration, we hope you'll register, is September 8th.
Thursday. Susan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Susan Carpenter is the native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Great to have her along, and certainly she'll be back, and we'll talk with her some more about native plants. Next week on Garden Talk, Ben Fuda from the Allen Centennial Gardens will be with us, talk about some flower bulbs that you may have overlooked and want to plant, and a whole lot more, of course. And then Monday, Labor Day, we'll be talking about birds. First, we'll look at the science behind the amazing egg, and then Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz will join us to talk about unusual bird sightings. Stay with us. Lots in store.